Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. We are back from Here We Still Stand. Of course, if you're an avid listener, the episode you listened to right before this episode was the live episode from Here We Still Stand. Hopefully you got to watch that episode live wherever it was that you were watching it. It was streaming a lot of places, so hopefully you got to be a part of that. If you want to watch that episode or just any of the stuff that we did at the Here We Still Stand live conference, the easiest way to do it is to go to YouTube and go to the 1517 YouTube page. Watch the whole thing. You can scroll through and find particular things that you're looking for. So a ton of content there. And if you've never been to the 1517 YouTube channel, now's a good time to go and subscribe to that. If you did miss it and you're bummed, you don't have to have missed it. You just will have missed it live. You can go back and still watch all that content. So we're going to leave it up there. So go over to 1517 on YouTube and subscribe to that and watch the Here We Still Stand conference. Chad, it was good. We got to be in the flesh for a change.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, of course it wasn't as good as most years because we didn't have all our people there.
Yeah, we were missing like 500 people.
Yeah. Besides missing those 500 people, it was great because, you know, like everybody else, this year has kept us apart. Yep. We usually get together, the 1517 staff usually gets together 2 or 3 times a year, plus conferences. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great chance for us to spend 2 or 3 days together and reconnect and get to both watch some good content and to produce some live as well. So that was great.
Yeah, I mean, the people that work, for 1517 had not all been together, I don't believe, since Christmas of
It was last December. Yeah, that was it.
So that's a little bit of time to go by when you're doing the stuff that we're doing to not be together at all. I mean, obviously we had a lot of Zoom meetings and all of that sort of stuff, but it was good to see each other when we hadn't done so in 10 months. But
yeah, so we got to record the lost episode.
We did, yes. That monkey is off our back. Genesis 15 is in the books. Now, when we, I'm sure we'll continue to get those emails as we get new listeners and they start over and they're like, "Where's 15?" And now we just point them way up in the archives. So you got to go all the way up to episode 200 and whatever it is, and you could find that episode there. But we did manage to make it through the whole chapter though.
Yeah, so we did. Yeah. I mean, we could have easily. I told somebody we could have easily split that into about at least 2 different episodes, because I mean it really is a extremely deep text, but yeah, we got through it and got through it well. I didn't feel like we had to rush through it or anything, so if you're a long-time listener, you can go back and now you will be complete.
That's it. Yeah, so. Genesis is we finally finished technically the first book of the Bible. It took a little while.
Right,
it took a minute. Well, we got to pick up back in 1 Samuel 14. We left sort of right in the middle of a narrative here. Saul has become an altar builder, build his first altar, and he builds this altar, and things are going to get a little tense.
Yeah. If you remember from early in the story, the soldiers of Saul informed Jonathan that he was in trouble because his dad had made everybody swear this vow that they would not eat until the end of the day when they had conquered the enemy. And of course, Jonathan did not know this. So he was sticking his staff down there and getting a little honey and refreshing himself. So that's going to be the rest of that particular story. So we're in chapter 14, verse 36. So Saul says, "Let's go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." So Saul's finished building his altar. He's ready to go back to war. And everybody's like, "Hey, sounds great to us." They say, "Do whatever seems good to you." But the priest steps forward. Remember the priest that we encountered earlier in this chapter. This is a long chapter. This is the grandson of Eli. So the priest steps up and he's more or less saying, well, Saul, I'll tell you what, why don't we put the brakes on for a minute? Let's draw near to God first. So let's inquire of God and find out if this is actually what he wants us to do. So verse 37, that's what Saul does. He inquires of God and he asks a question. It's kind of a, you know, a yes or no question. Shall I go down after the Philistines? And then he has another question. Will you give them into the hand of Israel? But it says he did not answer him on that day. Now, I wish I knew more about how this all worked. You know, if they were using these lots, the Urim and the Thummim, then how do you get a no answer? How do you get no answer at all?
Yeah,
I mean, I don't really know how that works. We don't have too many details about how the casting of lots actually worked, but typically you get some answer.
Right.
But you get no answer in this situation.
It's interesting. So the no answer in Saul's mind means something's up.
Wrong. Yeah, yeah. Something must not be right. So Saul's got to get to the bottom of this, right? So we're going to have this little day in court, if you will. We're going to find out who the guilty party is. So Saul goes on to say that all the chiefs of the people need to come near him, and he's going to conduct a little investigation. Because we're going to find out how this sin has happened today. And then he goes on with this. This is verse 39. Talk about, you know, wanting to eat your words later. He says, as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan, my son, he shall surely die. So in other words, he's saying, listen, whoever's guilty, I don't care if it's my own son. He's going to have to pay the penalty. Now, of course, we all know it was Jonathan. Saul does not know it was Jonathan.
We know that Saul's conclusion is going to be the sin that is committed here is the eating, which is a dumb thing to do in the first place, as we established. Now, has Jonathan actually committed any sin here? I don't think so. Like, he didn't know anything about this oath. God didn't say to make this oath. I don't think so. But certainly in Saul's mind, he's like, I think somebody ate something.
Yep. That's exactly what he thinks. Yeah. It was doubly dumb, right? I mean, it just was a ridiculous oath to begin with. And it was also ridiculous because, yeah, let's make sure that our soldiers are as weak as possible when they go out to fight.
Yeah.
No general ever wanted that for his soldiers.
You also, like, when you're making this statement, like, you need to make sure everybody's there. I mean, I know Jonathan snuck off and everything like that, but it's hard to hold guys responsible for doing things that they didn't know that they weren't supposed to do. Especially something that, like, you would never assume you weren't supposed to do.
Right, yeah. And I think, I can't quote chapter and verse on this, but I think it's pretty certain that even if it was a vow that was, you know, not stupid, a valid vow, if someone doesn't hear it, they're not obligated to keep it.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're unaware of this, then there's no way you can actually break it because it was never binding upon you to begin with. Oh, so anyway, he goes on verse 40. Well, let me finish verse 39 because this is an interesting way that it ends. After Saul says that, it says, not one of all the people answered him. Probably because most of them are thinking, oh, great, now what's going to happen? Because a lot of them knew what Jonathan had done.
Yeah, he makes this statement as a, I'm going to show you how committed I am. Obviously not thinking, of course, this is not a statement you make if you think there's any chance that it is Jonathan.
Yeah.
This is a statement you make to make the people believe that you are real serious about what you're saying. And the people seem that they're like, ooh. Like,
probably not a good idea. So, here's how he's going to do this. So verse 40 says that he tells all the people, so you're going to be on one side, and then Jonathan, my son, and I will be on the other side. This seems kind of strange to me. I don't know why he separated them out this way. So, but you got like one huge group of soldiers, and then you got this two-person group of soldiers. So Saul and Jonathan are standing over here. All the other people are on the other side. And the people say to Saul, okay, do whatever seems good to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think they think that they assume that he's going to get to the bottom of this. He's like, I'm going to put Jonathan over here with me. They're like, yeah, you do that.
Yeah, you do that. We'll see what happens. Okay, so verse 41 is one of these examples we've seen it before, where the text that have come down to us are not all identical. So if you're going to translate directly from the Hebrew text that we have, which is called the Masoretic text, that's what most English Bibles are based off of. So if you're going to go with the Hebrew here, you're going to have a real short verse. I'll read it to you. Therefore, Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, give a perfect lot. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. Okay, so that's New American Standard. Pretty short. I mean, it makes sense. But if we're translating from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation, they have a much more expansive text that they were either translating from or possibly expanding to make it make more sense. So here's how the ESV, for instance, reads. Therefore, Saul said, O Lord God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant this day? If this guilt is in me or in Jonathan, my son, O Lord God of Israel, give Urim. But if this guilt is in your people Israel, give Thummim. And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. So it really doesn't matter. I mean, in the end, it's pretty obvious what's going on here. You have some sort of division already established, where you have Jonathan and Saul on one side, the people on the other. They draw the lots, you know, the Urim and the Thummim, the two lots were kept in the breastplate of the priest, used to make these kind of decisions to determine the divine will. So, you know, they cast the lots, and the lots fall to Jonathan and to Saul. We were joking before we started the podcast, you know, this is kind of weird, right? A weird way to determine God's will. But yeah, there were a lot of different ways that ancient peoples determined the will of their gods. We were joking about how they'd watch the flight of birds, or, you know, they'd check out the liver of sacrificial animals. They could look at the clouds. There's even some sort of means by which they would like pour molten metal into water, and whatever shape it came up with was supposed to be indicative of the divine will. So a lot of kind of crazy ways that supposedly you could determine the divine will. But for God and for the Israelites, it was pretty straightforward. You know, if it's this lot, it's yes. If it's this lot, it's no. Or if it's these lots, it's that direction. If it's these lots, it's the other direction. So anyway.
And it seems like what Saul's doing here is he's taking the leadership, him and Jonathan, and then dividing it among and separating them from the people. He said, we're going to find out if this is a leadership problem
or a
people problem. And he seems he has to be kind of surprised when this happens. If he has a large degree of faith in this method, he's got to be surprised when it falls to him and Jonathan. This is not what he was expecting. This seems like a move that you make to first show the people, look, the reason that God's not answering has nothing to do with the leadership. It has to do with the people. Right.
Yeah.
So right away, it's like, well, this was not a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess just to finally complete the action. I mean, it's pretty obvious now, unless Saul is just outright lying, who the guilty party is. But he goes on and he says, okay, well, it's down to me and my son. Cast lots between me and Jonathan. And of course, Jonathan was taken. So you got to wonder what's going through Saul's mind at this point. I guess you don't have to wonder a whole lot, because he does speak, and what he says is pretty startling. So verse 43, he says to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. So Jonathan told him, he said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of my staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I must die. Now, I don't know exactly how to read that, because you can read that, of course, with all kinds of different tones of voice, right?
Oh, I read this with one tone of voice. The tone of voice that I would say it in. I'd be like, you'd be like, what'd you do? I'd be like, well, let's see. I dipped my stick in some honey, and then I ate that. So definitely going to have to kill me.
We're on the same page here, actually. I think that's probably exactly the tone of voice that he used. Because if you look at what he said earlier in the story, when he was informed by his soldiers that his dad had made them all swear this vow, he said, this is verse 29, Jonathan says, well, my father has troubled the land. In other words, he should never have said that. He's just made trouble for all of us. Look, I tasted a little bit of the honey, and all of a sudden my eyes have brightened. So in other words, this was stupid. My dad should never have said this. All he's doing is causing problems for all of us. So when he responds to his dad, it's got to be just like dripping with sarcasm. Like, yeah, I ate it. And here I am standing right in front of you. So I guess you're just going to have to kill me. And Saul says, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. And when it says surely, Hebrew has a way, it has a verbal form called an infinitive absolute, which sort of looks like you're just repeating the verb. So it's like, you shall dyingly die, or you shall die.
Yeah.
So you shall surely die, Jonathan.
Yeah. And you think that probably that the reason Jonathan also is like, yeah, all right, is that the people are obviously still there. Like they're watching this go down. And so Jonathan is like, yeah, I ate that. I ate some honey. By the way, I never hear about your oath in the first place. But I ate some honey. Here I am. Guess this is the day I die. Obviously, it's like a ludicrous thing. And he's got to think like there's, is this like, yeah, I guess you, yeah, dad, I guess you just have to kill me in front of all the people.
Mm-hmm. And, even though I was the hero of the story.
Right. And Saul, though, also kind of, I think, probably feels like, I sort of have to kill you in front of all these people because that's what I said I would do. Like, yeah. Literally, even if it was you.
Right. It's kind of a King Herod birthday situation, right? I made this vow. I made this promise in front of all these people. And so, I guess I've got to stick with what I said. Well, we'll see. We'll see what the people have to say in response to this. They're having nothing to do with it. Verse 45. So the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die? Or shall Jonathan die? Who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, because he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued, or literally ransomed, Jonathan, and he did not die. Well, of course. It's speculation here, but you can't tell me Saul was not relieved.
Yeah, he didn't get his way
in this situation.
Yeah, I feel like this was like an easy thing for the people to talk Saul out of. Like, I'm sure he had to like feign a little bit of protest, but you know, they're like, we're not going to really kill the guy that just did this, right? I mean, well, that's not what you do. Well, like I said, listen. We don't have the whole thing, but surely somebody went and made an argument similar to this. He didn't hear the oath, therefore it wasn't binding on him. So this, you don't have to, like, you have a way out. And then Saul's like, oh, that's a good point.
I hadn't thought of that.
But if he had heard it, I mean, I would kill him, but you're right. Since he didn't hear it, we'll not go through with this today.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty easy to save face in this situation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in some ways it's sort of a win-win situation in the sense that Saul can still come out looking like, yeah, he was very serious and pious in all of this. And then the people can come out looking very, you know, compassionate and thankful for the war hero. So, yeah, in the end, it works out well. But we don't usually do morals to the story here, but one moral to the story here is don't make stupid oaths.
Yes.
Just let your yes be yes and let your no be no. I think somebody important once said that.
Yeah, and never say, I'll kill anyone, even, and then name someone really important to you.
Yeah, that's another good
truth
to draw out of this. Yeah. So that really wraps up the narrative of this chapter. But we do have a few verses that sum up a little bit about who Saul is, his family, some of the things he did. It almost gives the impression that we're going to tell you a few things about Saul, because everything after this is going to go downhill precipitously. So this is what we have. This is 47 through 52. So anyway, verse 46 first, it says, Saul went up for pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So that wraps up that story. Verse 47. Now, when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, kings of Zobah, the Philistines, and wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. So, first of all, one little comment about this. It's kind of a strange way to phrase that, verse 47, right? When he had taken the kingdom over Israel. I mean, it almost makes it sound as if it's not something he received, right? It's like something he had to sort of acquire or, exert his force to receive. And so I can't help but wonder if when the author was pitting this, like he chose that particular word, which is an active verb, to kind of communicate something about Saul. There wasn't just him receiving this, but he was, as it were, trying to claim ownership of this kingdom in some way. But anyway, he takes the kingdom. He fights against all these people. Verse 48, he acts valiantly, defeats the Amalekites, sort of. We'll hear more about that in the next chapter. He delivers Israel from all those who plunder them. So that's kind of a summation of his military victories. And then we hear more about his family. So we've heard plenty about Jonathan, but he also has a son by the name of Ishvi and Malkishua. And then he has daughters, and their names are given here. The name of the oldest is Merav, and the name of the younger is Michal. We will hear more about her when we get to the story of David. We haven't met Saul's wife yet, but verse 50 says that her name is Ahinoam. And then, interestingly, we find out that the captain of his army, whose name is Abner, is also Saul's uncle. Now, Abner is going to play a big role when we go through the rest of 2 Samuel and even into Kings. So Abner is going to come up quite a bit as, first of all, an antagonist to David, and then later, actually, one who goes over to David's side, which will be his demise. But Abner. So all this time, it's kind of good to keep in mind that Abner was the uncle of Saul. And then we've already met his father, Kish. We're told about Kish, and then it wraps up with verse 52. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff, or he attached him to himself. In other words, he sees a guy who's a good fighter, he's a good soldier, he's a brave fellow. He's like, hey, come join my smaller group of bodyguards, if you will, or my smaller manned army that I keep ready at hand.
Yeah, so he's got like he's building up his Rangers, right?
Yeah, that's it.
He's got a special group.
Yeah, he's got a special group of soldiers. So, and as David did too. Of course, David had his mighty men of valor, among whom was Uriah, but a lot of others too. And these were probably his closest, most trusted soldiers. Those who were very good at what they did, and so he gathers them around himself, just like most kings do.
Yeah, we have good reason to think that those guys were pretty legit.
Yeah. I suspect that they were definitely the cream of the crop. And that is chapter 14. So long chapter, 52 verses, but we got it covered. Interesting story. Now chapter 15 is it's kind of the, you might call it the nail in the coffin of Saul, as far as his any chance that his kingship might be redeemed, any chance that he actually might have a possible future as the king over Israel, is demolished in this chapter for good. But it's like no chance whatsoever chapter 15.
Isn't it weird how this king thing with Saul, in some ways, like it never fully happened. This guy is the king, but not the king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. It's sort of like a biblical pattern, right? I mean, it's like God will put forward the first choice, but the first choice is always a bad choice.
Yeah.
Kind of deal. You know, it's like, you know what? I'm going to give you Adam, but he's not really the Adam that you're going to want, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to want a second Adam. I'm going to give you a king, but he's not really the king that you want. I'm going to give you another king. I'm going to give you David. And you could sort of say the same thing about Cain, right? Eve thought that Cain was the promised seed. And it's like, no, that is definitely not going to be the one that you need. You need somebody else.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of a one step forward, one step back approach that God tends to take. And so that Saul is almost like you wanted a king? Well, I'm going to give you a king as punishment. Yeah. So your first king is going to be a total flop. And you're going to learn your lesson right away that trying to force my hand into giving you a king so you could be like the Gentiles is going to backfire on you.
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting about with characters in the Bible is that, you know, every once in a while you'll get a character that seems altogether bad. And every great once in a while, you'll get a character like Jonathan who seems like basically altogether good.
Mm-hmm.
That's not most of the time, though, because even in the case of Saul, Saul is a guy that is going to be, you know, rejected by the Lord, and he is going to turn out to not be great. But at the same time, it's pretty hard not to have a little bit of sympathy for Saul, who never sought this or signed up for this in the first place. And in a lot of ways, like he's ill suited in a lot of ways for this job, and that would be something that you could malign him for if it was a job that he had gone and tried to get.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah, I mean, we've already encountered some of these episodes early on where, well, some of the episodes he comes out as just a real hero, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his first military campaign, he kicked butt. I mean, he did a great job. Everybody was happy. He ends up sparing the people who had talked trash about him. So if all we knew of Saul was that one chapter, we'd be like, man, this guy, you know, he's a good dude.
And doesn't Saul like seem like he does seem very naive, but he also seems like a guy that's always trying to do the right thing the wrong way.
That's a good way to put it. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. It's like you see that in the case here. I mean, he's building altars, he's making vows. That all sounds like very, very pious, you know, very religious thing to do. He wants to make sure, hey, you know, we should probably consult God before we do this or that. So it's like he wants to do the right thing, but he never does it the right way. He always messes it up in some way.
Yeah, so he seems like he messes up certain things, trying to do the right thing. And I think that this sort of speaks to the embitterment of Saul, that where, I mean, at some point he has to be like, man, I can't win for trying, man. I mean, this all sucks.
Yeah, I don't know how he wouldn't have ended up that way. I mean, given everything that's happened so far, given what's about to happen, and then you know, the obvious mental issues that he begins to have, mm-hmm. you can just kind of see his life bit by bit begin to crumble around him, and we're already seeing some friction here between him and his son. We're going to see more of that as we go on. So he is a sympathetic figure. I mean, at times, yeah, you can come across as a jerk, but there's a lot of situations where it's like, ah, man, it's hard not to feel for him, because like you said, it wasn't like he, you know, sent in his resume, really want to be the king of Israel.
No, he wasn't on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I was looking for donkeys.
Yeah.
Looking for donkeys, ends up with a job that he doesn't want. Okay, well, we've got a few minutes left, so let's see how far we can get into chapter 15. Samuel reappears, right? Isn't it kind of strange how Samuel's like, he'll be like all over the place, and then boom, he's gone. And then he's back all over the place. So he just, like, you know, yo-yos in and out of this narrative. But he's back. He's back. So Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you as king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, listen to the words of the Lord. So that guy kind of sounds ominous, you know?
Yeah.
Anytime it begins that way, it's like, oh, especially if you're Saul, you're like, oh, great. What's coming now? Thus says the Lord of hosts. Typical prophetic introduction, right? Here's what the Lord of hosts says. I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has, and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. We got to go way back to understand this. I mean, like all the way back to the book of Exodus. It's kind of it's a strange story in many ways because, you know, a lot of time has passed.
Yeah.
Several centuries have passed since all of this happened. But God has not forgotten. In fact, we have in both the book of Exodus and in Deuteronomy chapter 25, God, I mean, he's perfectly clear that he is going to demolish, annihilate, blot out Amalek and Amalek's memory from under heaven because of what they did to the Israelites. If you remember the story, this is in Exodus 17 or 18. Anyway, the Israelites, of course, they're fresh in the wilderness, hadn't been very long. They've crossed the Red Sea and haven't even made it to Mount Sinai yet. So, you know, this is pretty early on. This is like, we'll say a month or two after they left Egypt. And the Amalekites attack them, but they don't attack them in any sort of brave way. They're like wolves who are picking out the weakest of the flock who are at the very back of the herd. So the Amalekites, like wolves, swoop in and they're attacking the weakest members. They're attacking from the rear, and so they're acting cowardly. They're acting with bloodthirsty, wolf-like intent. And because of that, God says, I'm going to blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And then he repeats that. Moses repeats that in Deuteronomy chapter 25. So this is, I mean, this is, we could have seen this coming because it was promised way back then, but it does seem like it was a long time to actually put this into effect. But that's what's going to happen. Amalek is going to be blotted out. That's what's supposed to happen anyway. And this is another case where, as we saw multiple times in Joshua, where you have the penalty of harem, right? That utterly destroy, or as some translations have it, devote to destruction. So this is the same thing that happened to the city of Jericho, same thing that happened to multiple cities when the Israelites were conquering the Holy Land.
Yeah, yeah. When he says, I'm going to blot you guys out, he means like the animals, everything.
Yeah, yeah. This is a complete annihilation. Yeah. I remember I was listening to a Jewish scholar talking about some subject. I can't remember what it was. And in the midst of his discourse, he made reference to Hitler, not by name, but made reference to him. And then he said, he used this Hebrew phrase. He said, Yimach Shmo. Something like that. I might not have got it exactly right. Yimach Shmo. And I rewound it and listened to it again, looked it up. So it's like the strongest Hebrew curse that you could ever utter. Hmm. It literally means, may his name be blotted out. So, and it's taken from verses like this idea that may the utter remembrance of this person or these people be completely annihilated from the human memory. So you can't get much of a stronger curse than that. Well, that's the commission. We'll see what Saul does. Saul summoned the people. He's got a bunch of them, 200,000 foot soldiers, 10,000 men of Judah. He gets everybody together, and then he goes to the city of Amalek, and he sets an ambush against the city. But before he does that, he's got to give certain people the chance to get out. So evidently there were some Kenites who were living amongst the Amalekites, and he says to them, get yourself out of there. He says, go depart from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness. That's your favorite Hebrew word there, Dan. Hesed.
That's it.
Yeah, you showed kindness to all the sons of Israel when they came up from Egypt. So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites.
Yeah, so this is one of those kind of things that makes you kind of like Saul, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Right. He's not like going to wipe out everybody, even people that weren't really directly involved.
Yeah, and it's a, and if you're trying to ambush people, it's a little bit of a risky move to try to go warn certain people because who knows what they're going to do. But he's like, hey, I don't, I'm only here to do one thing. I'm not interested in collateral damage.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of funny because Saul makes reference to what they did way back then, right?
Yeah.
So it's like this is still very much alive in the people's memory. So you Kenites, you were kind to the Israelites. Probably the Kenites are to be connected with the Midianites or the people of Jethro. And of course, they showed great kindness to the Israelites. So that was probably what's being referred to. But either way, the idea is, okay, you were kind. You showed compassion to the people of Israel. And because of that, you know, we're going to spare you. We don't want none of your blood to be shed. And they listened. So they go out from among the Amalekites. So verse 7 says that Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the oxen and the fatlings and the lambs and all that was good. And they were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. This doesn't sound like it was exactly what God had in mind.
No, and we're going to find out that Saul's explanation for this seems like another attempt to be pious in the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, as we'll hear next time, he's like, oh, well, I mean, they were all going to die. I mean, we kept the sacrificable animals to sacrifice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, if they were like, all the pigs we killed, you know, all the whatever else they might have had, we killed those. But look, there's a lot of good animals here. We could have some sacrifices. I mean, they're going to die. So either way, we can make this happen.
Yeah. We'll see next week how this goes. But I don't think there's a lot of reasons to believe that that's not what he was doing.
Oh, I don't think so either. I don't think so either. In fact, I mean, he keeps the king alive, right? He keeps Agag alive. But we also, I believe it was when they captured the city of Ai, they captured the king and they later killed him. They didn't like kill him immediately during the battle. So maybe that was what Saul was planning to do with him as well. We just don't know. This is one of these cases where, man, I would like to sit down with Saul and say, so what was the plan?
He's like, I'm going to sacrifice all of this guy's best stuff to our God and then I'm going to make him watch. And then I'm going to kill him.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these cases where we wish we knew more about his intent, because you could read this sympathetically to Saul and say, yeah, I mean, maybe that was kind of what he had in mind. But as we will find out next time, that was not what that's not what he's going to hear from God. It's not what he's going to hear from the prophet Samuel when he shows up. And we're going to have a very heated discussion and a very bloody end to Agag, as we'll see next time.
Yeah. All right. Well, next time we will get Samuel's response to misplaced piety, and we'll see how that goes. Guys, go over to the YouTube channel over at 1517. Just go to YouTube, search 1517, and subscribe to that, and you can watch all the Here We Still Stand live stream. Even though it's not live, you can still go back and watch it. While you're, you know, searching around the internet, it's still time to pre-order Chad Bird's new book, Unveiling Mercy, which is coming out very soon now. I mean, we're less than a month out, so get that pre-order in so that you can you get that on your mailbox as soon as it drops. All right, Chad, I'll see you next week.
See you then.